Hello and welcome to Epochs number 95. And this week I'm joined by Dan.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Yeah, pretty good.
And I thought we could have a conversation, something a little bit different this week. Have a conversation just about the history of money, the history of economics, history of markets.
Sounds like a rip-roaring time. Absolutely. Let's do that.
Because I am actually interested, I'm sort of an all-round history nerd. I'm interested in all sorts of things like the history of medicine.
Right.
The history of money, history of economics, all that sort of thing. Obviously, your background is perfect for this sort of thing, I think. Just to mention, if people, I think I've mentioned it before once or twice, but I used to work in asset management and investment banking.
Yes,
and
yes.
But your knowledge, I know your knowledge is far superior to mine.
However, well, not necessarily about this history stuff, because you've got a couple of things on the agenda, which, definitely a bit more your skill set, but I'll chip in wherever I can.
Cool, yeah. Well, we may not get to them all. I've got a fair few here, but we may not get to them all. But some of the sort of big famous ones, it might be nice to go over.
Mm.
And just talk about it. I think one of the things to mention or to talk about is how history repeats itself in all sorts of ways, but particularly with the history of markets.
Yeah.
The same sorts of things go on again and again.
There's often a common theme, isn't there, to the kind of the reasons that brought it all down. Well, it's pretty much always overstate spending and borrowing. If it's a combination of those two things that crop up every time, effectively.
Yeah, even going back to the ancient world.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that things that happened in the ancient world or in the Middle Ages, financial collapses and things, bubbles, the same thing still happens in our world.
It's the same pattern of behaviour, isn't it? Because the one constant is going to be human behaviour that occurs across all of these. And that basically doesn't change from one century to the next.
Yeah.
So even though the numbers may change and the asset in question that is getting blown out of all proportion, that can change. But the human nature is consistent. So if you can understand what's going on in a lot of these historical examples, it's going to give you a framework of understanding for the next financial crisis whenever that occurs. Probably not long now.
Yeah, right. Yeah, any day, probably.
Yeah,
exactly. But the thing of human psychology.
Mm.
I think it's also quite interesting that, in lots of ways, it seems that human psychology hasn't really changed since the ancient world. The modern mind is a bit different, but only a little bit.
Mm.
Most people's sort of core motivations about wanting
to... It was all driven by the lizard brain, isn't it? It's either fear or greed.
Wanting to protect your family and wanting to make a bit of money.
Yeah.
That was the same in the first century AD
and show off a bit like our first example. I mean, that all comes down to showing off.
Right. Mm. Yeah. Well, let's jump straight into it. The first one I wanted to talk about is tulip mania.
Yes.
So-called tulip mania. Arguably one of the most famous financial collapses there's ever been.
And there was kind of a legitimate reason for getting into the tulip thing in the first place, because I mean, you've got to remember, this is a very Calvinist society at the time. They're very austere, you know, they only wear black. There's not really any method for them to show off. I mean, if you're a rich dude today, I mean, you go through the process, don't you? Buy a Maserati and then eventually a football club, depending on how rich you are, and you sort of go up that sort of scale. But in Calvinist Holland, they didn't have any way to show off apart from a big house and an art collection. And there's only so much of that you can do. Eventually you run out of wall space. So they decided to express themselves. The only thing that they could use to add a bit of flair was tulips. And now tulips, you've got to remember, they're not native to Holland. They actually come from some mountain region in Asia or something like that. And there was basically one guy who went out there and he started finding them and sending them back home. And the basic tier, like the red ones and the yellow ones, they took to Holland climate really well, and they grew everywhere and they became really popular. But you also had these ones with these sort of tiger stripe patterns on them that were very rare. And actually turns out the reason is because they had a virus in them. So they were very rare with this sort of pattern effect. But the other product of the virus is that they didn't produce many buds. Sometimes they only just replaced themselves. They didn't produce any extra ones. So you had these genuinely rare bulbs. So if you're a wealthy person in Holland, there's no way to express yourself in any other means to display a bit of colour. Bulbs are becoming popular. Then, of course, the thing for the rich man to do is to collect the ultra-rare versions. Yeah. And start putting in that. So you can start to see, there was a legitimate thing as to why the tulip mania got going in the first place.
Yeah, I could definitely see it.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean, it started off anyway, fairly reasonable, I think. Like most markets probably start off fairly reasonable. But just got to extreme proportions.
Well, take the dot-com bubble. I mean, that was a sort of similar thing. There genuinely was, back in 2000, legitimate excitement about, you know, where internet stocks could go. And as we know, I mean, even if you invested in Amazon or Google at the height of the dot-com bubble, even though they sort of crashed afterwards, they came back that and far, far more afterwards. So there was a legitimate thing going on then underneath it. But it's just that it got into a bit of a hype cycle, and that's kind of what happened here with these tulips as well.
Mm, yeah, the hype train for sure. Yeah. Just put it in some historical perspective. It is very early. We're talking the first half of the 17th century, so it all sort of seemed to collapse in 1637 very quickly as bubbles burst very quickly over a matter of days. It's 1637. But earlier, a few years earlier, it sort of took a few years to build up to that. So, Holland in those days, it was actually split into two, you know, the more southern part controlled the Spanish Netherlands and then the Dutch Republic higher up. Because the first half of the 17th century, you didn't really have what we would call a middle class exactly. The idea of the modern concept of the middle class doesn't go back that far. And yet it had started to emerge in
the Dutch Republic. So what did you have, just an army of plebs and a few very wealthy?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But in the first half of the 17th century in the Dutch Republic, it was starting to emerge because there were so many, it's sort of a merchant class, really.
So what about the artisans, the candle makers and the innkeepers and the dressmakers? I mean, what would they have been? Would they have been in this sort of emergent middle class?
Exactly, yeah, exactly that. They were the emergent middle class, right?
Right, the artisans,
And as well as a type of merchant class where people that, you know, aren't fabulously wealthy, aren't sort of landed gentry, not landowners or anything, you know, true capitalists that own many mills or anything like that. So not that. But they've got a fair bit of money. Well, they've got the right term for it when you've just got disposable income,
yeah,
or even fairly large disposable
to invest
income.
In a tulip garden,
and that's exactly as you say. And you haven't got that much you can spend it on.
Yeah,
if you're not fabulously wealthy and you can't buy ships, right? You're not that rich.
Because you've definitely got a fair bit of money. Those huge townhouses, and it was art, and below that there was. There was very little else to be sort of getting on with. Mm. So people started to develop these sort of beautiful gardens of tulips sort of out the front.
Mm. It could have been anything, really, though, couldn't it?
Yeah.
They could have sort of latched onto a number of things. It just happened to be tulips.
Given the society at the time, it was quite difficult for it to be something else. Because of the strict Calvinist religion, the reason why tulips worked is because they came from God and therefore they couldn't be... declared heretical on the basis that, you know, they were, because if you tried to wear ostentation clothing, that would have been declared heretical and that would have been out straight away. But tulips, because they come from God, you can't question them on that basis. And also because, like you were saying, disposable income. The other part of disposable income is disposable time. So when you're poor, you spend all of your time working, and when you start to become a little bit more wealthy, you start to take more leisure hours. And again, strict Calvinist religion, they couldn't find a way to basically deploy that. I mean, they couldn't go rock climbing, for example, or something like that. But gardening, you know, that was seen as honest, you know, decently religious, what is it, Protestant work ethic type stuff.
Right.
So they could deploy themselves doing gardening. So that became a popular middle class artisan hobby. So it gives you the flowers from God. It gives you the color. It gives you the decent work ethic. So it's a hobby. So it's basically one of the few things that they could actually sort of engage themselves in. And like you say, I mean, when this bloke who went off to Asia and he started sending back these bulbs and they started to become more popular, you know, everybody started doing this. Everybody who could started having a flower garden, and then the bubble started to really pick up once this was established as a thing that everybody was getting into.
Mm. That's a really interesting point. I hadn't really thought about that too much before, but you're absolutely right. That sort of very, very strict Protestantism, early sort of, you know, 17th century Protestant or Calvinism, a big element to that is one of the worst things you can do, one of the things God despises, is to be lazy or indolent, to just waste your time, to do nothing.
Yeah.
That's a terrible sin. To do that. I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, but you're quite right. That is definitely a big part of it.
But you don't want to spend all your hours working So gardening fits the bill. It solves the problem. And then what's interesting about the way that this really started to go bonkers is, you know, if you think about how you would normally trade tulips, it started off originally, you know, a guy would be sort of sat there with his tulip, and you could see it when it was bloomed, because these things only bloom for a short period every year.
Yeah.
And say, look, this is what it looks like. Would you like the bulbs that's coming off it? And they were like, okay, yeah, we have that. Fine. But then effectively what they did is they created option trading, because they started saying, okay, well, you know, we're going to, why wait until the bulb is actually available? Why not say, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to buy the option to buy the bulb from next year's harvest before it's even there, because that way you can extend the trade window.
A futures option.
Yeah.
Futures
effectively. Yeah. So because rather than waiting until the spring or the summer until you can see it, you know, why don't you trade it the previous autumn?
Yeah.
And say, you know, I want the, you know, you tell me that you've got a red and white striped tulip. So I'm going to put money down now to acquire the option to buy that in spring when the bulb is actually available.
Right, yeah.
And then.
That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. How quickly a future emerged, like almost straight away. Like, we'll start doing futures. Like, well, okay, fair enough.
Because you think of that as an entirely modern innovation, but it's not. It's just, because, I mean, a lot of these sort of derivative stuff, they get a bad rap because they get tied up in, you know, whenever there's a sort of financial crisis and so on. But, as there was in this case. But for farmers, it's entirely legitimate to be able to want to sell crop establish a price today when you start planting it. So you know what your costs and your outgoings are and what your income is going to be. You want to take away that uncertainty element. So
it's risk management, isn't it?
Yes,
it's
risk
a
management.
Tool for risk management.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you're a bakery, you might want to buy those futures for grain so that you know you've got that income supply, so that even if something happens, you know, if a new miller opens up down the road and he's trying to buy all of your supply, you know that you've got it locked in. So there's several good reasons for this. But you know, that was the element in the tulip thing that allowed it to start getting a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
Because then people started borrowing money to buy these options. So you might be putting down 10% of the cost of the bulb to have the option. And then you're borrowing that as well. Because if you're going to put down 10% of the cost of the bulb, why not just borrow, you know, take your 10 guilders or whatever it is, you know, borrow 50 guilders, and then you can go out and buy like 6 loads of future contracts. And the other thing with these future contracts is that you only paid the difference when you got to the point. So, you know, and you don't have to wait until the year to sell it. So let's say, for example, you know, you buy these future contracts for 10 guilders each, and then 2 months later, we're still 2 months before harvest time, people are now saying, okay, actually, I want to pay, I don't know, whatever it is, 100 guilders for these red and white striped tulips. So you can sell the contract. So you've only put down 10. You bought the contract for 50, but you're now selling it for 100. So you made 50 guilders on your 10. And then, you know, you've got the other 40 guilders that's going to be going to the farmer eventually. And so, you know, these things can trade, and you can see that before we even get to harvest season, these things might have been traded like 20 or 30 times. And this is fundamentally not that different to any of the modern crises where things get traded and bid up when you get into these bubbles. They just did it first.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what everything you said there, it all depends on, at the end of the day, you get your lovely, brilliant tulip.
Mm.
Now, if you don't, on whatever the future is, isn't actually worth all that much at the end when the contract ends, then suddenly that whole pyramid, it's not the right word, but the whole thing sort of falls apart a bit. People stop making a profit if that's not what happens.
Well, that kind of is what happened here.
Right.
Because they... there was all of this interest, all of this trading around these options for the tulips that are going to be delivered in the future. And the pieces of paper, the contracts to buy these tulips were being traded at a frenetic rate and getting bid up and bid up and bid up. And this basically went on for like, was it 2 years, something like that?
Well, I mean, the whole thing lasted a fair few years. Yeah, 3 or 4 years.
Right.
Well, it depends. It didn't just start on one day when people suddenly started going
crazy.
No,
there was this long build-up where tulips became a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the innovations around the trading of these contracts for future tulips got established. Then there was a speculation element for trading these things before the season began. And then there was the lending to buy the contracts, which were then getting speculated on. Now, all of this is telling the market there is massive demand for tulips. So what did people do over those 3 years? They went out and planted an absolute shit ton of tulips everywhere. And people focused on trying to make all of these rare elements and produce a black tulip and all of these sort of faddy things that they went off to do. So eventually, you know, you're sort of 3 or 4 years in, like you say, and then this absolute glut of tulips arrives on the market and you just can't support these high prices anymore.
All right, yeah. Yeah,
and that was effectively the end of it. Is the market said, okay, well you value these, you think these are rare. Well, let's apply a massive amount of them then.
Yeah, and the old supply and demand thing. Suddenly the market's been flooded.
You can see why that's a problem in this case because it was a whole bunch of these contracts that have been borrowed against for future delivery. So if there's now a massive supply and the price comes down, well that doesn't give any good because I've paid like 400 guilders for a future contract for a tulip, and now I can go and buy that tulip for like 20 guilders or 10 guilders or whatever because the supply has finally caught up with the demand.
Yeah.
And that was effectively the sort of crash that sort of brought it all down at the end.
Yeah. I mean, I worked for a commodities trading company once, not as a trader, I must make that clear. I was just a back office person. But yeah, there was lots of futures going on, lots of future options being taken out all over the place. And it's one of those things a little bit like the offside rule. Once you've got it in your head, it's not that complicated at all.
Mm.
But to try and explain it to someone who's got no frame of reference of what you're talking about, it's a little bit difficult to explain it clearly, don't you think?
Well, especially just a contract to get something in the future that you're paying for today.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Okay, yeah. And you sell, you put a future on any commodity or any actual thing, and then you sell that and you're out of the market once, right? So you've got no risk anymore.
Mm.
So you may have made a lot more profit if you just held on to it, but it's risky. It's a bit risky to hold on to it because you may or may not win, if you like.
Well, I mean, starting from the farmer's perspective, I mean, why not lock in a price today? I mean, now,
yeah, I just want to make a small profit right now and end my risk.
Yeah. On something that might potentially... his product could become more expensive or it would become cheaper.
Right.
But
okay.
he doesn't want to ever want to get in the situation where he has 1 year where he can't feed himself.
Right.
So it is better to lock in surety than have it go the other way. And then if things get into a speculative bubble, the farm down the road burns down, then the person who's bought the future contract is going to do very well as opposed to you. But likewise, another farm might get a bumper harvest and then your crop would be suppressed. So it's just taking away that risk element.
Yeah, yeah. So it is all a question of just managing your risk, really. And taking a smaller profit and locking it in.
Except in this case, it was a speculative cycle. Got a bit out of hand.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there was an interesting story. There was guy who owned a pub or an inn or something like that, and he had a fantastic collection of tulips. And he died, and he left behind these orphan children. And there was an auction to sell off his tulip collection. And I think it was something like 80,000 guilders that they raised by selling off his tulip collection. And then that was effectively the peak of the market.
Right.
And a few days after that, the next time they tried to do an auction, just didn't go anywhere. Didn't happen. It was like the confidence had been knocked out of it.
Well, that was the next thing I wanted to talk about is confidence.
Yeah.
And just confidence in markets, all sorts of markets, not just tulip futures in the 17th century, but today. How interesting that is. I mean, well, first of all, say 80,000 guilders in the 17th century. That's a fortune.
Yeah.
That's a king's ransom, isn't it? That's an absolute fortune.
It was like 3 or 4 children, but, you know, if they were vaguely sensible, they would never need to work again in their lives.
So just say then, just quickly about they get them usually come from Central Asia, I believe, but they get them through the Ottoman Empire.
Yes.
And so people started trading them at first, sort of in a relatively reasonable way before sort of the futures thing got worked into it. And then, as you say, they started allowing you to buy on the margin, so to speak. Yes. You only had to put down a fraction of it. So again, it's like leveraging. It's like it's all very well if at the end of the day you make a profit, you essentially win. But if you don't, you're then just in a giant hole. You're just in a giant hole at that point.
And when you get to the end of this whole thing, you know, you've got this extra supply of tulips that's now come onto the market. You've got all this borrowing against, you know, these future contracts are now not worth what you sort of paid out for them. They had to effectively sort of restructure the debt. You know, the kind of thing that I'm hoping that the US and the UK and other Western economies are going to do now with their debt piles, they're going to have to restructure it. Mm. And back then, I think the courts basically worked out somewhere between 3.5% and 10% of the value of these contracts had to be honoured. So if you had borrowed money to do these things, you had to pay back your lenders at you know 3.5%, 10%. If we were to do that for say the US debt today, that would mean them paying back somewhere between $1 trillion and $3 trillion, which the US could do. I mean that would be sensible.
That's a lot less scary, isn't it?
But the US is not going to pay back $31 trillion. So you know we are. If you look at the tulip bubble and think, oh, that's a bit bonkers. Well, explain the US. You know, bond market. I mean, it's just as, but there's no way the US is going to pay back $31 trillion without devaluing the currency to the point where $31 trillion isn't worth anything.
Yeah. I mean, $31 trillion. Just as an aside here, that's a truly, what's the right word? Absurd.
Yes.
Number.
Yes.
It's like I'm not sure. Is there even that much money in the world? I mean, I say money, even like assets. I mean. $31 trillion. It's sort of
it's
mind-boggling. It doesn't.
Yeah,
it's lost contact with the reality. Number,
that is vaguely comparable to about the amount of what we think of as money, as in coins and notes of the countries in the world.
Right.
It's sort of that level.
It doesn't really. It's sort of into the realms of not making any real sense anymore.
Yes.
Is it?
Yeah.
Right.
So they're obviously not going to pay back that value, but it's. It's a bit of a money sort of supply problem, isn't it? I mean, it sort of relates to the next one on our list, the one that I know less about. So you have to tell me more about 33 AD.
All right, okay, yeah. Well, if we finish up on the tulips. So what happened? And confidence, the idea of confidence in markets, in speculation, because in Holland, in the 1630s. Normal people realized that these tulip traders were making fantastic profits. You know, like as you say, at the height of it or near the height of it, a single bulb, a prized bulb, could fetch enough for worth the same as a mansion or something.
Yes.
So normal people realized, oh, there's just fantastic profits to be made. The market's going to go up. The price is going to go up endlessly. Because it is fair to say this is one of the first true sort of market bubbles. People didn't know, it's fair to say they didn't really know what would happen or where it would go or why wouldn't the price just keep going up? That's how a lot of people, especially normal people that weren't particularly financially savvy.
People think that today.
Right, okay, yeah, exactly. So normal people in Holland could be forgiven for thinking, well, not that it's that the market is overinflated or that the sense of value has been thrown out the window. They just thought there's money to be made.
Mm.
So then you get this thing where normal people, especially again, if you can buy on the margin, so to speak, that's not what they called it. But normal people thought, well, you know, I've got a small amount of money, a very small amount of money, but it's enough to get me in the market. It's enough
that I can buy one bulb and
I'll hold on to that.
You had people who were taking loans out against their tools.
Right, I mean, this just was normal people, peasants almost. Yeah. Right.
They were taking loans against their tools in order to go and buy these contracts for future delivery of bulbs. And the thing is, if you were the first guy who did that, you probably made out really well. If you were the last guy.
If you got out at the right time.
Yeah, maybe.
But then just loads of people. So then at that point, and there's loads of examples of this in the future or even in our time, where it's not a case of people that know the market well, know the value of the thing well, whatever it is, a barrel of oil, a tulip, whatever it is. It's not those people. It's people that simply want to try and make a profit. They don't know anything about the market at all. They don't know anything about watching prices or anything. They just think, I'll buy, and then at some point in the future, and it's entirely up to me, it doesn't matter when, I don't need to keep my eye on the prices, don't need to understand the market. Just at some point, whenever I fancy, I can sell, and I'll make a massive profit.
Somebody else will buy it off you,
And you get a mass of people doing that. You know, like loads of people that invest in the dot-com bubble is probably a classic example. And then when the bubble bursts, everyone tries to sell all at once. And so the price just absolutely plummets.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.